My name's Niall Hatch. I'm Development Officer with Birdwatch Ireland, and I'm also extremely proud to be a regular contributor to Mooney Goes Wild.
Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1.
Hello and welcome to the programme. Today, Terry Flanagan dissects bird poo. We delve inside the covers of Mooney's Bird Detectives free in today's Sunday World. And in his big interview, Dr. Richard Collins asks, what impact will the world's lockdown have on carbon emissions?
Do you have a positive view of the effects of COVID-19 on the environment or a negative one?
Yeah, overall, I'd say it's quite neutral. You know, once the crisis has passed and it starts to go into the back of people's heads, it will just be remembered, oh, you remember those days when we had the lockdown and so on. But I think people's behaviours will often go back to where they were. And a part of the reason for that is climate aspects aren't probably the first thing on many people's minds. So when they make a choice, it's not the first rationale when they make the choice, would I do this because of climate? It will be because of other actions. And so I think people will tend to go back to how they were before.
Interesting stuff, I'm sure you'll agree. Don't forget you can text us now about anything at all to 51551. We are waiting to hear from you. Now, if you've got your assortment of Sunday papers in front of you, I want you to go to the Sunday World, because if you haven't already done so, do it now, because inside there you will find a free 32-page pullout featuring Ireland's favourite feathered friends. It's Mooney Goes Wild in association with the Sunday World and Birdwatch Ireland. And if you get your copy, you can become a bird detective. Yes, it's called Mooney's Bird Detectives. We've been at this kind of thing for almost 14 years now with the Sunday World. For a little bit of background, here's Jenny Lambert, Marketing Manager with the Herald and the Sunday World.
Yeah, 14 years, Derek. We started with Colour My World. That's and we used to have thousands of entries. Our readers love anything to do with wildlife and nature. There was always a huge appetite for it. Mm-hmm. And that's why we produced this Mooney's Bird Detective book with Birdwatch Ireland.
Yes, Niall has done a fantastic job. I'll talk to Niall about that momentarily. But just explain to listeners what's in this little booklet, if you would.
Okay, so the little book is A5. It's mm-hmm. handy to carry around while you're spotting and identifying your birds. It features all of Ireland's best-loved summer birds. Mm-hmm. So you can go around to your local park, or now the restrictions are lifted, you can go further mm-hmm. and find the birds, tick it off. And also in there, there's top tips to becoming the best bird watcher you can become.
Oh, do you want to give me some of the tips now?
No, you'll have to read the book.
So that came out today with the Sunday World.
It is,
now,
yes.
Tomorrow,
yes.
Continuing on this theme, we have a special poster.
The Herald, yes. So tomorrow we have an A3 double-sided poster, wildlife themed. We're featuring Ireland's top 10 garden birds. Mm-hmm. There's lots of fun facts in there about bees and bats. And there's activities and puzzles and a great competition.
What can I win?
You can win a pair of binoculars and a family membership for 1 year with Birdwatch Ireland.
Fantastic. Where would you get it, Jenny?
Only in tomorrow's Herald, Derek.
Jenny, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Derek.
Thank you very much indeed to Jenny Lambert and to the Sunday World and to the Herald, where you can get that free double-sided poster tomorrow. But if you have the Sunday World at home, grab out this free 32-page bird guide. It is really terrific, Niall. Congratulations, you've done a wonderful job on this, I must say. So just explain to our listeners what's in there, a little bit more detail if you would.
Well, thank you, Derek, I appreciate it. And it's really good for Birdwatch Ireland to get our name out there as well. So this is a guide that we've put together. I've written the text for it, and it's describing some of the best loved Irish summer birds, as Jenny said there. So it's obviously not a comprehensive list. We have hundreds of birds in Ireland, but it's to whet people's appetite. It's some of them are very common, some of them are rarer, but they're all in some ways very significant in different parts of Ireland for the summertime. So there's a selection of some garden birds, there's farmland birds, there's water birds, there's seabirds, all sorts there. So it gives you a good overview of the diversity of avian life that we have in this country.
And fantastic photographs, I have to say.
They're beautiful, aren't they? Many of them were taken by my Birdwatch Ireland colleagues. Special mention should go to my colleague Brian Burke, who took a lot of them, but also of other photographers who allow us to use their work as well for things like our Wings magazine and our children's magazine as well. So we're very lucky to have the use of those photographs. They really help bring it to life in a very real strong way, and it really is beautiful. It's really been put together very well by the Sunday World.
There's a lovely photograph of a Barnell by Mike Brown.
Mike's a fantastic photographer, and he's the best Barnell photographer I've seen. And if you're here close, you can see that Barnell there is actually carrying some prey as well. So it's quite there's lots going on in these photographs. And it's got a little bank vole there in its claws. And right opposite that page, that's on page 10. And on page 11, right beside that, there's Black Guillemot, which is one of my own favourites. I think it's such a smart looking bird. And beautiful, beautiful picture there by Bill Quinn.
And you can see its feet are so rosy red. In fact, actually, I'm wearing rosy red gloves.
So you are.
In the studio today. And they're the exact same color. I mean, those feet are so... Why are the feet so vibrant on that guillemot?
And also inside its mouth is just as bright red as well. So the beak is closed in this picture, but when they open their mouths, you see the same colour. Yeah. It's thought it might be a signal between the pairs, but nobody's fully sure, actually.
Yeah, there's a whole lot of them. I was looking at them last week, these same black guillemots on the South Pole wall. They're sitting up there and they have their white... because they're black, and then they have white patches on their wings. And, well, they were walking up and down after each other, and one would get near to the other. They were worse than pigeons, jumping off into the water. There was all kinds of carry-on going on, except there was no carry-on. It was all throwing shapes is what they were up to.
Yeah, yeah.
But they're easy to see if you go to the right places, as I suppose most of these things, because you have different habitats included. You have the seashore, you have
that's right.
You have different, and then roseate terns. I mean, where will we see those? Only in the very same place where they are out in...
Rockabilly Island has been a great success story for the roseate terns.
It really has. It's actually one of the biggest conservation success stories, not just in Ireland, but in Europe. That species has now pretty much been saved from extinction, has been brought back from the brink. And the main sort of powerhouse for this is the work that my colleague Dr. Stephen Newton does on Rockabilly Island. There's a colony there now of 1,600 pairs of three bird of tern wardens out there now this summer. That's in conjunction with the National Parks and Wildlife
Service. The school in Skerries, wasn't it? It was making the nest boxes.
There's 700 or 800 nest boxes out there at the moment.
Yeah, good school there. I see on the back page you have a whole list of hints as to how to be a good bird watcher.
Yes.
So you have to wear practical clothes and pack your bird watching bag, and you've got to bring drink and snacks. I like that bit.
Well, liquids, and you don't scare the birds. That's one of the first rules.
That's the third rule. Bringing the grub is the second rule. And then you leave everything as you find it, and then you have fun and spread the word.
Most importantly, you have fun and you spread the word, become a bird watcher.
That's it. And we have a lovely ad for Birdwatcher and a membership there as well, because the thing is that we know with the COVID-19 situation, a huge number of people have come to wildlife and to nature. It's become very important in people's lives. People have been very aware of what's happening in their gardens, which is why tomorrow in the Herald, the Garden Bird Post will be particularly interesting to people as well. And a lot of people are getting involved with this, and we wanted to put this booklet together to show people the diversity of life we have here in Ireland when it comes to birds. Birds are a gateway to all sorts of wildlife. They're the most visible form of wildlife that we have. So we're hoping that people will get into birds and then be interested in butterflies and in mammals, all sorts
of
things.
And there could be a wildlife or plants as well, and they don't run away.
Wildflowers, can I just thank Birdwatch Ireland in the guise of Niall Hatch sitting here for helping us put this together, and to the Sunday World, because they're the ones who put the money up to make this happen, and it then becomes free in the paper when you buy the paper. But you know, it's a real collector's item, there's no question. And the fact that, as Jenny said, it fits into your pocket, you can bring it with you, and it folds up, it isn't hardback, it's very simple to get around, and it's those pictures are actually really beautiful. One of my favourite pictures in it is a quite simple one in many ways. It's a picture of a flying mallard which Richard Mills took.
That's right. Richard is a fantastic photographer based down in Cork, and he's well known for his bird work. He actually did a lot of sports photography as well. But so he's very good at taking the action shots.
It's a great action shot.
Yeah, it really is, that would
explain a lot. So that's the Sunday World today. If you have a copy, if you haven't, you can probably pop out and still get a copy of the newsagent. Or tomorrow, a free poster with a competition which will appear in the Herald. That's only in tomorrow's Herald. More details on our website, rte.ie/Moody. Also tomorrow, on our Second Chance documentary slot on RTE Radio 1 at 10 p.m, you can hear more about the common swift. Niall Hatch takes us into the life and times of the common swift. In this clip, he's talking to his colleague Brian Caffrey about swift bricks.
In new builds, for example, we're encouraging architects and planners to think about swifts and maybe build in, for example, swift bricks into these new builds to try and provide more homes for them in our cities.
I suppose we better describe what a swift brick is.
Sure, so a swift brick is a cement block of the same dimensions of a regular one, but it's just got a small entrance hole in the centre of it, perfect size for a swift to nest in, and inside the brick is hollow. So when you're building a new build, this swift brick would generally go in at the top, the last block to be laid or last brick to be laid, and that will provide a safe and secure place for swifts to nest in. But one of the great things about swift bricks are once they're put in a building, generally a new build, it's there for the duration of the life of that building. So it's a home for life, if you like, for a swift. So it's a great way to try and help protect the birds.
Well, that's our second chance to hear documentaries from The Mooney Goes Wild. 25 years of archive right here on RT Radio 1 tomorrow at 10 p.m.
Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1. Visit the website rte.ie/Mooney.
Now, the humble hedgehog, one of Ireland's favourite mammals, is the subject of a new national survey, and you at home can take part. That's right, folks. Researchers at NUI Galway and the National Biodiversity Data Centre are asking the public, and that includes our wonderful listeners, to take on the role of citizen scientists and help out in recording hedgehogs for the survey. There are a number of ways in which you can help. Firstly, as casual recorders reporting sightings of living or dead hedgehogs whenever you see them, to the Biodiversity Ireland website. For those who would like to get more involved in the project, there is a garden hedgehog survey where you can examine your own property for hedgehogs using a homemade footprint tunnel. Sounds very interesting. Or indeed a wildlife camera, if you have one. More on that a little bit later on. We're joined now from Galway by Elaine O'Riordan from the Zoology Department at NUI Galway. Elaine, you say that hedgehogs are one of the most understudied mammal species in Ireland.
That's true. The poor old hedgehogs, we don't have a lot of information about the numbers of hedgehogs in Ireland. They don't lend themselves very well to research because they're small and they only come out at night, and they occur in quite low densities. So they're hard to survey.
Yeah, there was a survey published there recently about hedgehogs in Britain that got a bit of traction here. And this survey in Britain found that there were losses of 50% of hedgehogs in rural areas and 30% in urban areas. So, you know, when people were discussing this, they were saying, well, what's the story in Ireland? And the thing is, we don't have this information at all about hedgehogs in Ireland. Sure, we don't.
No, we don't. We know that the hedgehogs are, you know, quite common, and we know they occur in every county in Ireland, but we don't really have any baseline information on what the numbers are like, and you know, where they are distributed really. You know, do they prefer urban areas, or are they more common in the countryside? So that's what we're hoping with this survey, that we'll be able to get that kind of information so we can measure in the future if the numbers are going up or down.
Yeah, when I was in the Biological Record Centre way back in the 70s and 80s, the way we mapped hedgehogs was on a 10-kilometre square basis. And once you got one record for the 10-kilometre square, that was your dot, and you could fill it in one by one by one. So you're not looking now for information to give you a distribution of where these occur. You actually want population studies. You want to know how many hedgehogs they are, what they're doing, whether they're alive, whether they have young, whether they're eating the dog's dinner in your garden, whether it's a squished one on the road. It's more information than just presence, absence and where it was, isn't it?
That's it, exactly, yeah. So we want to see, you know, what kind of habitats they're using, and then we'll hopefully be able to build up a kind of a picture of, well, you know, we might find, you know, so many hedgehogs per hectare in kind of farmland or in gardens and parks. They might be, you know, more densely populated or less densely populated. So we'd be able to get a more detailed picture of what the numbers are like. Yeah.
So this is actually going to be the baseline study. So we really won't be able to say they have declined or they have increased, because we don't know what they were before. Now, the hedgehogs, of course, are hibernating species, so they'll have been coming out of hibernation. They came out of hibernation, I suppose, this year early enough in April when the food was around for them. They feed on, they're traditionally carnivores, and they feed on slugs and snails and invertebrates and things like this. So there's no point in coming out of hibernation until then. And then they're starving when they do this, and they go tearing around looking for stuff. So the first impression people get of them are squished dead on the road. So starting at the beginning then, if people find squished dead hedgehogs on the road, do you want to know about those, given that they're gone?
Yes, absolutely. And particularly roadkill is a very useful way as well of kind of measuring the numbers, because a lot of the information that they even came into the UK report there was from roadkill, monitoring roadkill over the years. And, you know, the corresponding rises or drops in roadkill can be an indication of what the population is doing. So absolutely, roadkill records are really, really important. And live hedgehog sightings are very, very important as
yes,
well.
Yes, they're very important too. Presumably this year there will be fewer roadkill records because lack of traffic due to COVID. So maybe that's one place where COVID has been a benefit to something.
Mm-hmm. I suspect so. I haven't seen a dead hedgehog myself on the road yet this year. But then again, of course, my gallivanting has been quite curtailed as well.
Now, if we want to get live records, which of course are much more interesting altogether, there's a couple of problems. First problem is that the hedgehogs come out at night. They tend to be a nocturnal species rather than a daily species. So it's not like you're looking for squirrels, which are out in the daytime. These things come out at night and we're not out at night. So the first notice I often find that people have of hedgehogs is the dog barking in the garden going mad, because the hedgehog is at the dog's dinner and is eating the dog's food. So would feeding hedgehogs or putting out food for hedgehogs be a way of attracting them so that you'd know whether they were there or not? Would that be a good plan?
Yeah, a lot of people do, and a lot of people will put out food, and you can put a little box or something over it as well to keep the foxes and the cats out of it. So feeding hedgehogs is one way to attract hedgehogs into your garden, but also, you know, any steps that you do to make your garden more nature friendly, if you're increasing the bugs and the creepy crawlies, you will you make it more attractive for hedgehogs. So leaving areas with kind of long grass, with hedges and with piles of leaves and logs. And of course you have to leave an entrance for them to come in as well. So if you don't have a little gap in your hedge or your wall or your fence or a hole in the gate, they're not going to be able to come in. So make your garden accessible, and putting out food and especially water is very important as well for them at this time of the year.
Now, they don't really hold territory the way other things do. So you could have hedgehogs in your garden and then they move on. They've eaten all your snails and slugs, they've eaten all the dog's dinner, and they go off to somebody else's garden the following week or the following night. They're not very faithful to territory, are they?
They kind of have a home range and they'll move around within that, and they'll have a few different day nests as well within that area. So they might come a few nights and then not come again for a while. But they have a general kind of a home range that they patrol, but they're not strictly territorial. And you might have two or three or more hedgehogs with their home areas overlapping.
So being a nature detective now is a great thing, particularly now when people are looking for things to be doing in a very small range. So this idea of making a homemade footprint tunnel to see will there be a hedgehog in your garden. Tell it, I know there's probably details of pictures and patterns on the website, mm-hmm. but give us an outline of what is involved with this.
Okay, well, this is a nice activity for families to do, or for anybody to do, and it's you know, it's what I'll be doing as well myself, to survey for hedgehogs, as you said, because they come out at night. You often don't know if you have hedgehogs in your garden or not, and other than going out and patrolling all night with the torch, the other way to do it is to make a footprint tunnel. So what this is basically, it's a little triangular tunnel sort of shape. It's made out of a folded piece of corrie board. You know, I'm using election posters at the moment to make some of mine.
Hopefully you won't be needing them shortly, but anyway.
They're not getting them back now. So you fold your sheet of cardboard or your corrie board into kind of a triangular shaped tunnel about a metre long, but it's not too precise. And inside that then you put a sheet of paper at either end on the floor, and some ink. You can use just non-toxic poster paints or some graphite powder or charcoal powder mixed up with oil, and put that along the top of the paper, and a little bit of cat food or something to attract them in. And then the next morning you come and you have a look, and you should hopefully see hedgehog footprints, but you might find cats or rats or fox prints. You wouldn't know what you'd find in there.
Anything else as well. Now, the other thing that you don't want to be encouraging is cattle traps. Hedgehogs in fields and in farming areas quite often fall into cattle traps. These are the grids that keep cattle from going places that they shouldn't. But if hedgehogs go across those, they fall in and they die of starvation. Should we keep an eye on our cattle traps to see if there are any hedgehogs in there?
Absolutely. I would say if you do have a cattle grid or cattle trapper on your farm or at your gate or your house or something, keep an eye on it. Or just actually what you could do is just put a ramp in, a plank of wood or something, at a nice, gentle sort of gradient, and they should be able to climb out themselves. And garden ponds are the same. Sometimes they fall into garden ponds and they can't get a purchase to climb out again. So a little ramp in your garden pond or your cattle grid to let them climb out.
Elaine, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Bye.
Take care. See you.
Very nice voice Elaine has, hasn't she, I must say? You'd have to compliment somebody for their voice. Can you say that?
Why can't the English teacher children how to speak? I was listening to My Fair Lady the other day and he was saying in Ireland they haven't spoken English for years. So it all depends on accent. She's a lovely accent. So have I. So
I've grown accustomed to your face.
Well, on the face is one thing, but it's the accent.
Isn't that from My Fair Lady?
It is, yes, indeed, yes.
And Rex Harrison never sang that, I believe. I think somebody else sang it, if I'm not mistaken. I could be wrong. I'm sure somebody out there will know. Anyway, lots of text messages coming into 51551. Hello, Derek. Just wondering if there are a lot more insects out at night. I saw the front of the car was covered in flies this morning, something I haven't seen for a while. Thanks, says Sean. I suppose, were you driving the car? Did you just not notice before you went to your lab last night? Or was the car parked up all day and has been for the last few days? And why would they die on the... Anyway, come on.
Well, they probably...
What's going on?
They probably were... There could be two reasons. First of all, they could have had it under a tree and they fell down onto a windscreen because trees like elder might have lots of insects in them. But more than likely, he was driving along and they got banged into it and he was out at night, didn't see it until this morning when he got up and looked at his car. And this used to be the way long ago. When I was young, me and Finn McCool, I had my first car in 1974 and we had a special spray that you sprayed the windscreen with to get rid of the dead flies off it. There were that many flies around. And now because of so much intensive farming and insecticides and sprays being used, there are much fewer of them. So if he got covered with flies this morning, it's obviously he's driving around in places where there's less intense carry-on going on. So this is a good
sign.
It's a good thing.
What was the name of that spray you got? Was it Fly Away?
Oh, I have no idea what it was. How do I remember? How do you remember my name? Never something the name of a tin from 40 years
anyway,
ago.
Anyway, come on, you've got some there as well.
I didn't approve of anyway. Okay. Hi, Derek and all. Help needed. My brother in Clontarf has bees in his garden, says Claire, and they can't fly. Is it genetic?
Well, it certainly bees that can't fly?
Well, how could it be genetic? Because if you can't fly, you wouldn't be doing much good as a bee. So it certainly isn't genetic. Move on. He had tried giving them a honey mix and having flowers beside them to try and get them some nutrition. They are dying as all the crawling around is exhausting them. What's wrong and what can we do? Well, now, bees only live for 6 weeks and they die of exhaustion anyway. You have 3 weeks going to the flowers to collect pollen to bring home to feed the babbies, and then you have 3 weeks going to the flowers to collect nectar to bring it home to make honey to feed the grown-ups, and then you die of exhaustion. It's called being as busy as a bee. Well, don't recommend being as busy as a bee. So they fall down and they die of exhaustion. So obviously there's a lot of them if that's the case, and no point in trying to feed them. They've shot their bolt, they're gone. On the other hand, in your garden you'd have solitary bees. And they could be in people's gardens. And these have their nests. They're solitary. They don't have a queen. They're not a community. They're not a communal species like that. Each one has a little nest, like a hole, like the size of your finger in a bank. And they go into those and lay an egg and feed it and then come out. So they kind of land on the ground and walk and go in and out. So perhaps she's looking at solitary bees as well, or maybe the two lots are there. Maybe some bees are actually dying because their race is run, and maybe she has solitary bees.
And what are the ones
well.
That live in the ground?
Well, they're all solitary bees.
They're
we
solitary
have 79
as well.
Species of solitary
Didn't
bees.
Didn't we go to a house in Rathgar one time, a garden
That's right.
in Rathgar?
They were solitary bees. They're mining bees. They're the solitary
mining
bees that
bees.
Are mining bees.
That's the one I was
and
thinking
of. There's other ones as well. There's ones called leaf-cutting bees. Have you ever heard of those, Niall?
I have. Actually, I had one in my garden just last week, which was wonderful to see. I have some blueberry plants in pots in my garden, and it was a nice day. And I just heard this very faint clicking sound. That was very odd, coming from one of the plants. I looked in, and there was a bee there munching away, sort of semi circles of the leaves from the plant and then flying off with them.
Wonderful.
Amazingly
yeah.
clean cuts, and is carrying them off. Kept coming back all day doing this. Now, okay, it was destroying the leaves on the plant, but I don't mind. I love seeing
the
bee.
Did you follow the bee to see where it went?
I went over my back garden wall and just kept going to the distance.
Carrying,
yeah, I couldn't see where it was going, but it came back quite a lot. So yeah, amazing to see that. This one, another one of the solitary bees, that is. I have a question here as well. It's come in from Brendan Conroy, and he says, my brother-in-law lives on a small farm in Stradbally on the Waterford Copper Coast. He has told us that his old outhouses, which are normally home to a multitude of wonderfully active swallows and house martins, are empty this year for the first time ever. Why might this be? Well, I think it may have something to do with something we were talking about a few moments ago about the lack of insects, because obviously with swallows and with house martins, they depend very much on flying insects. That's what they...
Now, we're talking about more insects, ain't this reckoning that there are more insects around it. They're all over the car.
We said they were stuck to the windscreen of the car. There were so many, and I hadn't seen that since the 70s.
Yes.
But maybe they didn't come. Maybe they didn't get as far as
Ireland. Well, we're seeing a real downward trend on those species. And the fact is that now that people are, you know, if you have one instant where people are actually noticing flies on the windscreen, it just shows you how much they have declined, because it used to be something you wouldn't comment on at all. It was a fact of life that you would see every day during the summer. Now when it happens, you remark on it, and I would guarantee it wasn't, it wouldn't be as spectacular as it would have been, you know, a few decades ago. And we are unfortunately seeing with a lot of these migrants that cross the Sahara Desert, so trans-Saharan migrants like swallows, house martins, willow warblers, cuckoos, they're all declining. We're seeing the population really, really being hit very badly, and they have two things in common. They eat only insects and they cross the Sahara on migration. And it seems that climate change is having a big effect there, but also changes in agriculture, pesticides, destruction of hedgerows. There are far, far fewer insects than there used to be.
And the Sahara, of course, is getting wider as well, too, isn't it? So there would be fewer insects above the wider Sahara.
That's right. And also, it's already at the very limit that those birds can survive. So fewer and fewer of them are surviving the migration. So it's a problem we're seeing across the country. We have a project in Bird Watch Ireland called Spring Alive, and it's springalive.net is the website. And people all across Europe, Africa, and Central Asia do this. We get a huge number of records of swallows in. We ask people to report their migrants. So swift swallows and cuckoos are the main ones we do there, and house martins as well this year. And over the course of the last decade, we're seeing fewer and fewer reports, and we're seeing also the swallow migration is shifting earlier. They're now arriving about 2 weeks earlier on average than they did 30 years ago. Something is going out of kilter and they're having a hard time. And of course, one thing that it's a real bugbear of mine, but people contacted us and want to, you know, how do I get rid of these house martins nesting on my house? Cherish them. It's wonderful to have them there. They need the help.
So they're coming before the insects are there and they die of starvation in the first 2 weeks.
It's coming out of sync, yeah. It's tough.
All right, you can text to 51551 and please tell us your name and tell us also where you are.
Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1. Email mooney@rte.ie.
Bird poop, bird poop, birdie, birdie, birdie. Poop, poop, poop. Bird turd, turd from a bird. Turdy, turdy, turdy. Birdie, birdie, birdie.
Isn't that just a great song? I absolutely love it. I found it on YouTube. The details are on our website, rte.ie/Mooney. Not just details about the song, but details about bird poo or bird turd. Turd from a bird. Terry Flanagan has more on this story. Terry, who's in his garden today, I believe. Terry.
Yes, I am. I'm here in the garden.
How's your leg, by the way? Poor old Terry hurt his leg.
Ah, it's improving, thank God. Anyway, getting back to poop. I don't know whether it's because more people are outdoors during these weird times, but one thing's for sure, and that's we're definitely receiving more texts and emails from listeners about bird poop, and especially bird poop landing on them. And even our own producer, Anna Leddy, she's had the misfortune of it happening to her, not once, but twice. She recently told me her story.
Hi, Terry. I'm hoping you can help me with something, Terry. I'm speaking to you from my garden in Dundrummond, Dublin. And I've been working from home for the past 12 weeks of lockdown. And we're really fortunate that a couple of years ago we had a kitchen extension built. So we've had nice spaces to be in. And I know how fortunate we are in that. Now, the garden is by no means enormous. It's about 8 by 9 metres. And I'm certainly no gardener, so it's mainly green shrubs and bushes. And I wanted to make the outside patio area an extension of the kitchen. So I continued the colour scheme of the interior out into the outside, buying furniture with white frames and blue cushions. I also painted the walls blue and made a feature of them. So I really love it. I love looking out at it as well as sitting in it. And I don't know if it's directly related to the recent lack of human activity, but I've become really acutely aware of birdsong in the garden recently. And people on the phone actually comment on it when I'm working on the phone because the noise of the birds can be so loud. So it's really fantastic that the birds are having such a field day, but there's an awful downside to it. Because as you know, Terry, where you find birds, you're going to find bird droppings. And my God, do we ever have a bird poo problem in this garden. I actually got pooed on, not once, but twice in the one day. So it's no joke. And all during that beautiful weather, I spent a good deal of time when I wasn't doing my day job cleaning patio furniture and scrubbing garden walls, and I am fed up to the back teeth of it.
Now, Terry, you made a documentary about faeces for us not so long ago. Tell me something I didn't know.
Well, it's a food item for many insects like dung beetles. And did you know that there are literally thousands of different species of dung beetles, and they live on every continent except Antarctica? And why do you think an insect would want to eat poo? Well, it's because there's a wealth of nutrients still present in it. And these beetles, they can extract it. They love poo.
Anyway, let's get back to Anna Leddy in her garden and what you had to tell her about bird poo.
Terry, it's something that has always mystified me. Anyway, this thing that apparently getting pooed on is actually lucky. Doesn't feel like that to me. But so where did that come from?
Well, it's an old superstition. It originated in Russia. And I think, yes, around the world, most people believe that if you're pooed on by a bird, yeah, it does bring you good luck. And why? I suppose really it's because of the rarity of the event. Sailors, for instance, they still believe that bird poop should not be removed from the ship before the next rain comes. So why would you want to wash away good luck?
What's the chances?
Isn't that a great song? How come it never made it to number one? I found this on YouTube and it was recorded.
Really does depend on where
you... Oh, something very strange happened there. Don't know what happened there. Anyway, they're talking about bird poop. Have you been pooped on recently, Ada?
No, the last time I got pooped on was in Spain. I got pooped on by a swift, of all things.
Oh.
I was over in Cáceres in the middle of Spain. We went over there last summer and there were millions of swifts. I never saw so many. And as I was sitting outside, because you sat outside the tables, and I was dropped on by a swift, but it was a kind of a small little poo because they only eat tiny little insects.
Ah.
But I didn't feel terribly lucky. I was amazed. But anyway, the waitress came along and looked at my head and cleaned me with a big napkin and apologised if it was her fault the thing swift landed on me. It didn't land, the poo landed on me. That was the last time, actually.
That was the last. Well, I was dropped on during the week. Now, there's number one and number two, Niall. I was going to call you Niall. But when it comes to birds, there's a number three. Because birds do it all together, don't they?
They do. So it's when you look at bird droppings, I'm sure people don't pay too much attention to them, but you'll see a lot of white material in there. And that's the way that they're excreting the urea from their bodies.
Yeah, so it's all the wonders. And they've only one orifice out of which it comes.
Do. It's called the cloaca, and it's the reproductive orifice as well. And so it's where the females would lay their eggs from. And what happens is, you see, birds, they are very good at economy when it comes to water.
Yeah, so they're not lugging anything around with them.
Exactly. So, and so they're very, very efficient. They have a much more efficient digestive system than we humans do, or indeed we mammals do. And so they're able to reduce the water loss as much. They only need just the bare minimum of water they're losing, which means that they can therefore go longer without drinking. It's better for migratory birds. So they've evolved this. But it also means
it's very concentrated and full of nitrogen. Guano was what they called
That's
it.
Right.
And they used to mine it, apparently, in Peru. And it was on a ship with a cargo of guano coming from South America. It popped into Baltimore in North America and then came across to Europe, that brought the potato blight to Europe in 1845. So from Peru came the guano and came the potato blight, because potatoes obviously came from Peru
That's right.
Up to Baltimore, took on board, so it didn't pick up the actual blight in Peru. It picked up spuds in Baltimore, and the spuds were blighted and they brought them across. And that was how they actually managed to get potato blight, because they would never have blown across the sea. But once it got to Belgium, it was, and then over to Britain, it just came over in the wind to Ireland.
Indeed.
And so the rest, unfortunately, is history. But that was guano. Guano was very much used as a fertiliser and was well
regarded. There's two things it was actually for. So it was actually part of the US colonial powers. Actually, they had a special thing called the Guano Act. That's how they got Midway Atoll, which became very significant in the Second World War.
With seabird guano there.
Seabird guano.
It?
Yeah. And you might think, why was it such a commodity? So it was one for fertiliser, yes, but it was also used to manufacture high explosives for the military effort, because it's so high in these nitrogen compounds.
So you get blown grown up with a poo.
Absolutely. So that's why it was a huge trade. It was a huge business. But apparently being a guano miner was one of the worst jobs you could imagine. They got this horrible irritation in their lungs and actually shortened their lives. It was thought to be one of the worst jobs you could have, was mining guano.
No, the worst job of all was washing the lead. Because the women in Britain, they used to mine the lead. The men went down and mined the lead. The little boys brought them out on the trolleys. The little girls ran up to Mammy and Mammy washed the lead to make it clean because they got paid by the amount of clean lead. And the women died at 33 years of age of arsenic poisoning, because arsenic and lead are together on the periodic table, and cleaning the lead was getting rid of that. And your wife got greener and greener and greener and died at 33. I think you had to get a new wife to mind all the other children. But that was probably even worse, because you'd know if you married a lead miner, that was it, you were a goner at 33.
Really?
Horrible. Well, I want to tell you a word of a lie, Derek.
Yeah. Well, anyway, you mentioned My Fair Lady earlier, and I mentioned I've grown accustomed to her face, the song, and I wonder, did Rex Harrison sing it at all? We'll just remind you a little bit of the song if we can, please. I'm sure you'll know it if you've seen My Fair Lady.
I've grown accustomed to her face. She almost makes the day begin. I've grown accustomed to the tune that she whistles night and noon. Her smiles, her frowns, her ups,
her
downs are second nature to
me now.
Now.
I love that song.
Like breathing out and breathing in.
Anyway, what's it got to do with nature? Nothing. I just happened to say during it that I thought Rex Harrison, although he sang it, didn't actually sing it, but he did sing it, it turns out. As he says, it was originally performed by Rex Harrison as Professor Henry Higgins, who also performed it in the 1964 film version. So that answered me, didn't it? One of our listeners sang very much.
And he got an Oscar for it too, but there you go.
There you go. And we'll take a break and we'll be back to you after this.
Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1. Visit the website rte.ie/Mooney.
So my apologies to Terry and Anna for that little bit of a technical hiccup a little bit earlier on with their report. We lost it, so sure, we might come back to it again another time. Now, the ongoing coronavirus pandemic has claimed the lives of over 400,000 people globally, and seeing the introduction of severe restrictions on freedom of movement around the world, lockdown measures have confined us to our neighbourhoods or even our homes, as motorways became deserted, planes grounded and borders closed. Subsequently, transportation and industrial energy consumption fell by more than 1 billion tonnes of CO2 emissions as virus infections surged worldwide in March and April. A new study marks the first ever attempt to quantify carbon dioxide emissions on a daily basis for the world and for 69 individual countries in close to real time. Until now, annual CO2 emissions data has typically been years later. The study in the journal Nature shows that CO2 being released by human activity each day fell by as much as 17% during the height of the coronavirus crisis. The research projects an overall decline of up to 7.5% in 2020. Earlier, Richard Collins spoke with Dr. Glenn Peters, research director at the Norwegian Climate Institute, and one of the study authors.
Yes, so our emissions, as you were saying, 100 million tonnes a day, they're split across these sectors, and quite roughly at the global level, around about 45% of our emissions come from the generation production of electricity and other forms of energy, such as in the oil and gas sector and so on. Around about 20% comes from industry, so the production of steel or the production of cement. Around about 20% comes from transportation. This is primarily land transportation. A quite small share, 3% or so, comes from aviation, both domestic and international. And there's a range of other smaller sectors, but that's the big picture at the global level. And when you zoom into individual countries, you'll get quite some variation about those numbers. So, for example, if you have a country that has a clean electricity system, uses hydropower or a lot of solar and wind, the share of electricity will be lower and the share of transport will be much higher, which is quite important when we look at our results.
Well, now the COVID-19 struck, and that changed everything. And there was a kind of a plunge in CO2 emissions worldwide. Can you outline that for us?
Yeah, the restrictions mainly hit the transportation sector. So all the restrictions were pretty much around social distancing. We couldn't go out and meet people, couldn't go out to restaurants and so on. So the aviation sector, you know, in a sense, collapsed. Very big reductions, particularly with international transport, but also with domestic aviation in some countries. Reductions 60% or greater. But aviation is only a quite small share of emissions in most countries, so it contributed only a little bit to the total reductions. Whereas our land transport, driving cars and public transport like buses, because of the social distancing measures, the lockdowns really hit that sector. Now with reductions 60, 70, 80%, depending on the stringency of the lockdowns. So most of the reductions, about half the reductions, came from private transportation, public transportation, and those sorts of transport.
Well, did anything go the other way? Did any sector come up a bit with the change?
Yeah, it looks like what we call the residential sector, so basically people sitting at home, working from home and homeschooling and so on, that pushed emissions up slightly, just maybe around about 5% depending on the country. Electricity emissions actually went down, but not so much, you know, maybe 10-15%. And this is because the lockdowns didn't really impact on our electricity use. We kept the fridge going, we kept heating our houses and so on. So it didn't really affect electricity, but a slight increase in emissions associated with our houses and so on.
Well, how low did overall emissions fall, and when did they fall to their lowest point?
The global level, the emissions were lowest at the start of April, around about 17% reduction globally, which is quite significant. You know, if you look at how it's plotted out over time, you know, there's a little hump in February where the emissions went down and then they came up again and then they went back down deep again. And this is because different countries had their restrictions come in at different times. So China had the worst of their lockdown during February. Europe and the US, most of the lockdown sort of headed into later March and April. And so individual countries have had bigger reductions, you know, let's say 25% is sort of an average reduction across most countries. But globally, we only see 17% because different countries had their lockdowns come in at slightly different times.
Now, economies are beginning to revive. Now, can you detect an increase in the amount of emissions? So what is the trend that's taking place now? Has it continued down low or is it slowly creeping up already?
Yeah, well, we see the emissions starting to creep back up. The first country to look at is really China, and some sort of statistics are suggesting that China is almost back to normal. Of course, there is, you know, what is normal. So things like transportation, road transportation is coming back to normal. Electricity and industry is coming back to normal. But aviation, for example, is not yet back to normal and will probably take some time, even years, before a sector like aviation gets back to normal. So in China, you see the clear signal of emissions coming back or activity levels coming back to normal. And we're starting to see this in most other countries. For example, a lot of European countries are starting to relax their lockdowns now, and activity levels are really coming back up to not so different to what they were before.
Well, now we've been here before in a sense that in the economic crash back in 2008, 2009, and it resulted in a decline in emissions, but they bounced back up fairly quickly. Now, when it comes to this, this is a different kind of decline, a different reason for the decline, radically different. Will it rise and bounce back as quickly, or will it be a slower change?
Yeah, so this is a great question, and we'll slowly get closer to the answer as time progresses. But this crisis has unique characteristics. I think every crisis will have unique characteristics. There will be some sort of rebound, but I don't think there'll be a rebound anything as big as the rebound that we had during the financial crisis in 2008-09. Emissions rebounded extremely strongly after that, but there was a lot of government stimulus, and that stimulus could be effective. If we have government stimulus now, that may not be so effective because we might still have some social distancing, still a risk of the virus taking hold and having a second wave or something like that. And also, the sectors that are impacted are primarily, or particularly service sectors, and so stimulating them might be a little bit different to how we could stimulate sectors in the past. So this will have to see how governments can negotiate. Maybe it will be a little bit more like the oil crises in the 70s and 80s, with a little bit slower recovery that might extend over years. For example, tourism. Maybe tourism doesn't get back to normal for some years, if it ever gets back to the same way it was before. So there's a lot of uncertainties, but there will be a rebound, but how quick and how strong that rebound will be, we'll just have to sort of wait and see how things play out.
Well, what is your prediction for the net effect? Obviously, the airline industry has collapsed, tourism and so forth. The prospects there are very dim. There will be more car transport, land transport. So the overall mix, will it be an overall increase, do you think, or an overall decrease in CO2 emissions?
Yeah, this is quite a complex question, and you've laid out many factors there on where emissions could have, let's say downward pressure, and somewhere they might have upward pressure. So, aviation might take some years to get back to normal, but maybe there'll be more domestic tourism. How does that play out? We'll have to wait and see. I think private transportation is going to be a really interesting one. So people may turn away from buses and so on and may go back to their cars. So we could see a rebound which is even stronger, goes above previous levels with private transportation. Things like electricity, I'm sure, will bounce back. And industry, that's also going to be uncertain if, people are unemployed, people don't have as much disposable income, buying, less TVs, going out less to restaurants and so on and so forth. Maybe industrial activities will be slightly lower and suppressed for some time. So I think the net effect will probably take some time before we get back to those normal levels. Although on a positive note, there's various things which are changing in the background, such as the energy system is transitioning already. There's a lot of solar and wind going ahead, and those industries aren't being affected as strongly as fossil industries. Coal, oil and gas, renewables have been affected, but coal, oil and gas are getting affected much more. Renewables, solar and wind, are often cheaper. So if we go ahead a few years, we may see that we've transitioned a little bit further and globally emissions are on a downward trajectory. So we've sort of sped up the process in a sense. So this would be something interesting to see. And if that happens, then this would be a net benefit in a sense.
Thank you, Glenn.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure speaking to you.
Thanks to Glenn and to Richard. Lots of text messages coming in. This one says, Derek, here's a great idea for helping hedgehogs to climb back up if they fall into cattle grids. And it is to hang a pair of tights in the grid. It is an excellent ladder for the hedgehog. Is that a joke? Is that like a ladder in the tights? Is that what you're talking about there? Have you ever done that, Aina? Have you ever hung your tights over a cattle grid in the hope that a hedgehog would climb up them?
No.
Obviously, when you weren't wearing them.
I'm not an idiot, Derek.
Go on.
Anything that will help the hedgehog out of the cattle grid indeed would be a good idea. But, a piece of plank, and this is what we recommend. So there you go. But something. A pun. I have a better one. I have one here from a fella called Mike. It doesn't say where he's from, but he says, I've got a hive in my roof just above the wall. How do I get rid of it? First of all, I don't think we should tell him we're the wildlife programme, not the wild death programme. But anyway, how do I get rid of it? I tried the local bee man, but no success. Bees are in my house, help me please. I find that interesting. Local bee men and bee women are obviously, they're usually extremely helpful. So I find it hard to believe that the local bee man gave him no help at all, because bee men are always bee people.
Always. The old late Philip McKay would have been running down there
straight
away.
Yeah, but they're always anxious to get. So I wonder, in actual fact, is this a hive of bees at all? Or is it wasps in actual fact? Sometimes people mistake bees and wasps for the same thing. Hives in your roof, a nest in your roof above the wall, which is actually made from the timber of the actual rafters and things in the attic, would be paper for the nest. And if it's a wasp's nest, it'll be gone by Christmas, it'll be gone by Halloween, it'll go on its own. And
send
if it's
a picture.
Bees, Yeah, if it's
if
bees.
You
yeah, yeah,
we'll
send
the
picture. Yeah.
Email
but if it's a
bee,
if it's a bee's nest, it'll be there for years and years and years, except that Varroa will give it to them all in 2 years anyway. You know, but, you know, leave them there. What harm are they doing to keep her their way?
Very quickly, Niall.
Yes, we have a message in here from Fiona in Raheny in Dublin. She was walking in St. Anne's Park and a small black bird with a forked tail, she's not sure if it was a swift or a swallow, flew in circles around her at knee height. She wants to know, it did this five or six times she walked along, was it protecting its territory or was it something else? Well, my bet is it's probably a swallow. Could have been a swift, but probably a swallow. But you would have been walking through the grass, stirring up the insects, and what the swallow would have been doing is swooping down to try and catch them. So you're behaving like almost like the way we'd follow cattle in a field or something. Same sort of thing. You're disturbing the insects, and the bird wants to eat them.
So because it's eating on the wing.
It eats on the wing. They catch all the insects on the wing, and they
and
only eat flying insects.
Particularly if it's been raining and the grass is wet. Or
yes,
has been
that's right. That's why they fly so low.
Yeah.
They can tell when it's going to rain.
All right. You can email Mooney at rte.ie or visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. My thanks to our sound supervisor, Tommy O'Sullivan, today. Our broadcast coordinator is Jarlath Holland. Our researcher is John Riley. Thanks to Aina. Thanks to Niall, to Richard, and to Terry, and all the gang who worked on today's programme. Very much appreciated. We'll do it all again next week. In the meantime, do visit the website. Until next week, bye.
Visit the website, rte.ie/Mooney.
Mooney Goes Wild was produced and presented by Derek Mooney.